With the first paper being presented by Scott Abbott, titled One Lord, One Faith, Two Universities, The Tensions Between Religion and Thought at BYU. He's an associate professor of German at BYU, and he has written numerous articles and has a book on Freemasonry. And there'll be also be comments by Ted Lyons, who's the director of undergraduate studies at the David M. Kennedy Center in BYU, and he is a professor of Spanish.
At the age of 18, I left the oil boom town of Farmington, New Mexico, and headed north for my first year at BYU. The lush green campus at the foot of the mountains seemed like paradise. And at the center of that paradise was the honors program, its challenges and stimulations assuring that the paradise was more than a country club. Informing the entire experience was a complex web of religious theory and practice. I ran into professors who were both religiously committed and intellectually stimulating. The education I got from these religiously committed professors, trained at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Berkeley, was good enough to get me into Princeton and ensure that I do well there. It also prepared me to teach an LDS Institute class while I was there. After graduating, I taught for 7 years at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Those were good years as I wrote articles and taught students and published my first book and associated with good colleagues and taught another institute class. And I scrambled for tenure at a very exclusive university. Tenure was granted in March of 1988, and by April I decided to move to BYU. Answering questions of an incredulous dean and various colleagues, I described my desires to work at the university that had shaped me and that would shape my fellow Mormons in years to come. Some of them understood, some of them didn't. At BYU, I moved into a warm, supportive, and competent department. My teaching load is the same as it would have been at Vanderbilt. I've received generous research grants every summer that I've been at BYU. I've had a semester of paid research leave. I travel to conferences at my department's expense. Besides that, the library at BYU is good, and at a time when state libraries, libraries at state institutions, are shrinking, their budgets are shrinking, we've got an aggressive acquisitions policy. The academic climate at BYU has been stimulating. I've taken part in faculty seminars on feminist thought, on a French philosopher, Emmanuel Levinas. Richard Rorty, Terry Eagleton, Alan Bloom, and Martha Nussbaum have each been on campus for a week in the last 4 years and have led lively and controversial seminars. There are more women faculty members and more black students than when I was a student. There's a women's research institute and an active group of women students who have gained international attention with their innovative and forceful work on women's issues. Sexist language is officially discouraged at BYU. An official university policy on hiring women is one of affirmative action. This year, when my own department wanted to hire a non-Mormon woman who also had an offer from UCLA, we had extraordinary support from the Board of Trustees who waived normal deadlines so that we could go ahead and hire this woman, and she will be here in September. After 4 years, I'm grateful to be at BYU, and I'm sure that I made a good choice. I'm also aware that I'm not in paradise. Let me give a few examples. One, women faculty. There are departments on campus where official policy on women means nothing. 3 months ago, a science department voted to hire a man rather than a woman when several professors stated they would not vote for the woman because that would take her out of her home. Ironically, this was after a very frank interview the woman had had with Elder Dunn, Lauren Dunn, in which he had told her that she was exactly the kind of woman that BYU needed. In one of the departments of religious education, a woman professor who asked her department chair for a reduced teaching load so she could do more scholarship was told that if she wanted to draw a man's pay, she needed to do a man's work. She quit. In an elevator, a male faculty member recently accosted a young female professor with a question, "Who is home with your children?" The same woman received obscene phone calls on several occasions when she publicly expressed opinions not commonly held in Utah County. Another woman faculty member received phone death threats because of her controversial opinions. Two, an impending divorce between professors of religion and the rest of the university. If you look at the pattern of hiring in religious education, you will find an increasing preference for BYU PhDs and EDDs and church education faculty. In the Department of Ancient Scriptures, of the four professors, only three have their final degree from BYU, while nine have their degrees from other universities. Of the associate professors, three are BYU graduates and five are from other programs. Of the most recently hired faculty, assistant professors, five are from BYU and only two are from elsewhere. The percentage of faculty with BYU credentials thus progresses from 25% to 37.5% to 71% in the Department of Ancient Scriptures. In the Department of Church History and Doctrine, the numbers are more skewed toward BYU, and the trend is similar. There you see the progression from 64% to 90% to 100%. None of the assistant professors in that department have degrees from anywhere outside of BYU. So only 6 of 23 faculty hired from 1984 through 1991 have degrees from any school other than BYU. There's a problem, of course, with this kind of analysis, and that's that it doesn't tell you which of the BYU graduates turned out to be really good professors and which of the graduates of Duke and USC turned out to be lousy. What it does tell you is that for whatever reason, religious education has recently experienced the kind of inbreeding that weakens any academic department. They have decided to hire teachers rather than teacher scholars. They have chosen to use their own phrase, the tried and true former seminary and institute teachers, rather than the products of good graduate schools. While other departments on campus hire increasingly good faculty, and while students become increasingly good, and every year we have better students at BYU, this kind of hiring in religion will lead inevitably to second-rate status. For some on campus, the concrete and steel symbol of this creeping self-ghettoization of religious education is the steeple on the new Joseph Smith building, marking that building as church and the rest of the campus as not church. Contrast that trend with the vision of Hal Miller, Dean of Honors in General Education, in a memo recently written concerning non-religion faculty involvement in religion classes. Quote, by involving those outside religious education, students can be alerted to the fact that the gospel is what is most important here, that we are nearly all about the business of pursuing it, of plumbing its depths, of savoring its inexhaustible richness, of encountering its matchless spirituality. Most important is the message that we are in this together, so we teach and learn the gospel with one another. Unquote. 3. Tension between the faculty and the Board of Trustees. It has been almost a year since the First Presidency's statement suggesting that church members not take part in symposia like this one. Many of us on campus saw this as an order to mind our own academic business, in chemistry and law and humanities, and to quit thinking and talking about Mormon topics. Faculty in the sociology department drafted a letter to Rex Lee protesting the statement and asking for clarification. At about the same time, an assistant professor who had read a paper at the last symposium was called in by his ecclesiastical leaders in what seemed like an attempt to intimidate him. Several departments sent letters or delegations to Rex Lee in support of the sociology department's positions and arguing against arbitrary limits on academic freedom. A persistent rumor was heard and often denied that there was a hit list of 6 faculty members who were soon to be fired. A faculty member named as co-editor of Dialogue received abusive anonymous phone calls and was attacked in the press. When the academic vice president resigned, rumors flew. Members of the Board of Trustees told faculty members privately that tensions had never been so high between the Board of Trustees and the faculty. One specific example in its absurdity will show just how bad things are. A member of the Board of Trustees recently expressed contempt for a faculty whose elected advisory committee had recommended that we no longer call one another brother and sister at BYU. There was a document on how we should address one another. The document simply said that often in meetings, men are referred to as doctor or professor, and women professors of equal rank are referred to as sister. And the document suggested that we either refer to all of us as brother and sister or all of us as professor or doctor. But somebody had seen this document and had reacted and had got to a member of the Board of Trustees with the skewed statement that we wanted to no longer call each other brother and sister, and this person had believed it and had got back to our administration. This person had a sense for the university spinning out of control. BYU administrators' biggest headache, one administrator has told me, are ill-informed, biased end runs to the Board of Trustees. I would guess the Board of Trustees sees itself as enormously patient. But when complaints by members of the John Birch Society to a trustee can produce a request for a faculty member to be reprimanded, as recently happened, something is amiss. I have a paragraph now which I'm going to skip, in which I quote a new paragraph which was added to all of our contracts. And it's a paragraph stating that we should support the church, but it states it very explicitly. It's something we all knew anyway and something we all supported anyway, but it was just added this year to our contracts. In that climate, in the context of newly exerted control, the new document on academic freedom and competency reads like a legal document, making it easier to fire unruly faculty. It probably isn't that. I'm just saying that that in a climate of paranoia, even innocent things can seem troublesome. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that somebody isn't out to get you. So much for my litany of complaint. I know that every university has its problems. I'm grateful that ours don't include racially segregated and alcoholic fraternities, or a provost whose vision of a university doesn't include a library. Those were two of Vanderbilt's most pressing when I was there. But I'm at BYU, and the specific problems we have concern me deeply. Several of my examples show how individuals and departments within the university have inflicted wounds upon themselves and others in spite of official university positions and in spite of official positions of the Board of Trustees. I say in spite of, and I've tried to show just how good church support of BYU is. But I also want to say because of. Our collective stupidities aren't happening in a vacuum. While supporting education with economic gusto, some of our leaders say things that make education nearly impossible. There is a virulent strain of anti-intellectualism in the church. This is nothing new. Joseph Fielding Smith, for example, wrote in his journal in late December 1938, quote, "The more I see of educated men, I mean those who are trained in the doctrines and philosophies of men now taught in the world, the less regard I have for them. Modern theories, which are so popular today, just do not harmonize with the gospel as revealed to the prophets." Unquote. The basic and most destructive mode of this anti-intellectualism is to distinguish between faith and reason, setting the one against the other and the one above the other. And its purveyors are, among others, members of BYU's Board of Trustees. I don't think they mean to be anti-intellectual. In fact, there are indications in their writings and talks that they intend to support thought and education. What I'm talking about is the message that people hear, people at BYU who want to hear a certain message, or people in the church who want to hear the same message. I'm going to give an example from two fairly recent speeches by a member of the Board of Trustees. And what's interesting to me here is the division between spirit and mind. The first talk mentions blending, wedding, and mixing the spirit and mind. Quote, "The fusion of reason and revelation will produce men and women of imperishable worth. The combining of reason and revelation is the test of mortal life." That's a wonderfully affirmative statement. But then the speech arrives at what it itself describes as the crux. Quote, "Now listen carefully. It is crucial that you understand what I tell you now. There is danger. Church-sponsored universities are an endangered species, nearly extinct now." Unquote. The talk quotes a single passage from the recent debate on the secularization of church-sponsored colleges that asserts that, quote, "the schools that lost or are losing their sense of religious purpose sincerely sought nothing more than a greater measure of excellence. The language of academic excellence is powerfully seductive." Unquote. The talk further asserts that BYU can only be kept in faith with the founders if the, quote, "prerogatives of this unique Board of Trustees are neither diluted nor ignored. Theirs and theirs alone is the right to establish policies and set standards under which administrators, faculty, and students are to function, standards of both conduct and excellence. History confirms that the university environment always favors reason, and the workings of the spirit are made to feel uncomfortable. I know of no examples to the contrary, unquote. The talk goes on to say that, quote, the moral and spiritual capacity of the faculty and the spiritual atmosphere in which students are to learn must be caused to happen, unquote. It then repeats the role of BYU will be determined by the Board of Trustees, whose fundamental credentials were not bestowed by man, and whose right and responsibility it is to determine policy and approve all proposed changes in basic programs and key personnel, and establish standards for both faculty and students. Why the defensiveness? Why the fear? Why the distrust? Why the need to assert control? I find a clue in an earlier talk by the same trustee. It is an easy thing, the talk states, for a man with extensive academic training to measure the church using the principles he has been taught in his professional training as his standard. In my mind, it ought to be the other way around. A member of the church ought always, particularly if he is pursuing extensive academic studies, to judge the professions of man against the revealed word of God, of the Lord. And why shouldn't such academics be measure the church using academic principles? Because the talk asserts academics will castrate religion. That isn't his word, of course. Academic will castrate religion and true religious scholarship whenever possible. The talk gives as an example a friend, a church education system employee, who went east to do a doctorate in counseling and guidance. He chose as his dissertation topic the ward bishop as counselor. He was forced by his professors to delete references to the power of discernment and revelation. If he would do so, he was promised, he would become an authority in the field. His dissertation would be published and his reputation would be established. In the end, he both compromised and didn't compromise, and his dissertation became neither the inspired document it might have been nor the academic success promised by his professors. The writer of the talk reports returned to the modest income and the relative obscurity of the church educational system. He summed up his experience this way. The mantle is far, far greater than the intellect. The audience was to conclude from this talk that professors don't understand the things of the spirit, that academics are forced to produce spiritually sterile work, and that truly wise men and women will retreat from academia. The example was so foreign to my experience that I went looking for the dissertation mentioned in the talk. It turned out to be typical of many dissertations produced for weak departments. The purpose of this study, the author wrote, is to measure the counseling attitudes of bishops and seminary instructors of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and to compare their counseling attitudes with various measures of activity in their wards and classrooms. The startling conclusions were, there is a relationship between counseling attitudes of bishops and their effectiveness as bishops. Also, the amount of training received in counseling is positively related to counseling attitudes. The example is clearly bogus. The dissertation is a weak piece of work done for a weak department. To use it as a key example in a talk pitting academia against spirituality is unfair. Academia, at its worst, is indeed sterile, mind-numbing, and spiritually destructive. So is religion at its worst. But we don't choose to be academics or practitioners of a faith because of how bad they can be, but rather because of the power they give us to live good and productive lives. My recurring question is why, with our extraordinary theological background, in which all truth is meant to be circumscribed into one great whole, we insist on fearfully dividing instead of fearlessly circumscribing. Why the weak anecdotes about academic misfits instead of the academic and spiritual triumphs like Stephen Epperson's Mormon Historical Association prize-winning book on Mormons and Jews in the 19th century? Epperson wrote his dissertation at Temple University in Philadelphia. His non-Mormon dissertation committee was thrilled by the project and supported him while learning from his religious commitment. Or why not the example of Susan Tabor's oral history of her Delaware ward? The academics of the University of Illinois Press found stimulating and academically challenging. Why not choose as an example of scholarship growing out of faith Richard Bushman's fine history of Joseph Smith's early years that helped him move into a distinguished chair at Columbia University? or Hugh Nibley's massive set of writings on church-related subjects, or Paul Cox's heroic work in Pacific rainforests, or Lamont Tullis's work on Latin America, or Royal Skousen's work on the Book of Mormon manuscripts, or Fred Geddick's work on religion and law, or Daniel Graham's work on Aristotle, or Alan Bergen's psychology, or Wilford Grigg's Egyptian archaeology, or Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's Pulitzer Prize work on women's history. In these Mormon scholars' work and lives, there is no whining supposition that it's us versus them, that if the so-called secular academic world were just spiritually minded, they would award us all Guggenheims and Nobel Prizes. But the trustee whose text I've described, and he was an educator in his time, gives only negative examples, warns only of the seductive power of reason over faith. Again, I ask, why does he and so many others defend faith over reason in what our theology teaches is a false dichotomy? Let me give several examples to show there should be no split between the two. Hugh Nibley, in his now classic Zeal Without Knowledge, quotes Joseph Smith. The things of God are of deep import, and time and experience and careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts can only find them out. Thy mind, O man, if thou wilt lead a soul into salvation, must stretch as high as the utmost heavens. Nibley interprets, no shortcuts or easy lessons here. Note well that the prophet makes no distinction between things of the spirit and things of the intellect. Many Mormon scholars will tell you the process of study and inspiration is the same, whether the subject is physics, art history, a talk for word conference, psychology, or choosing counselors for a Relief Society presidency. This morning, David Knowlton very carefully distinguished between his anthropological hat and his Mormon hat. And as far as I could tell, he got absolutely no mileage out of that distinction. When we distinguish between religious experience and intellectual experience, or religious experience and mechanical experience, for that matter, we disregard the verses in the 88th section of the Doctrine and Covenants that describe the light of Christ. And the light which shineth, which giveth you light, is through him who enlighteneth your eyes, which is the same light that quickeneth your understandings, which light proceedeth forth from the presence of God to fill the immensity of space. The light which is in all things, which giveth life to all things, which is the law by which all things are governed, even the power of God who sitteth upon his throne, who is in the bosom of eternity, who is in the midst of all things. All experience of light and life, as I interpret this, is experience of God. I want to now go through a few experiences of Joseph Smith, and it's Dean Jesse's meticulous scholarship that have made this accessible, to show you events in Joseph Smith's life leading up to the dedication of the Kirtland Temple. He bought a book in which to record his thoughts, and he wrote his name and then the phrase, misspelled all the way through. Record book bought for to note all the minute circumstances that comes under my observation. The following years, between 1832 and 1836, were a time of intense getting wisdom of all kinds. Attending class daily in the elder school with lectures on medicine, grammar, Egyptian artifacts, and finally those lessons learning Hebrew with Professor Saxes, Joseph filled his diaries with entries like the one on Wednesday the 17th of February, 1836. Attended the school and read and translated with my class as usual. And my soul delights in reading the word of the Lord in the original. And I am determined to pursue the study of languages until I shall become master of them, if I am permitted to live long enough. At any rate, so long as I do live, I am determined to make this my object. With the blessing of God, I shall succeed to my satisfaction. 1 month later, he dedicated the Kirtland Temple. His dedicatory prayer is full of his enthusiasm for learning, and he quotes from the Revelation, that is the 88th section of the Doctrine and Covenants. The temple will be a place where the Son of Man might have a place to manifest himself to his people. You all know the phrase, as all have not faith, seek ye diligently and teach one another words of wisdom, and you could go on and finish that. There's not even a hint in that dedicatory prayer of any conflict between reason and faith. Rather, in the house of the Lord, truth may be circumscribed into one great whole. The temple as we use it today isn't a place where we go to study Hebrew grammar or medicine. although it's often been a place where scholars like John Widtsoe or my bishop recently related a story like this, where a scholar has gone with academic questions in mind, and the atmosphere of the temple opened their minds to new answers and to new questions. But a shift in temple function doesn't need to lessen our vision. Church universities become, in the best and broadest sense, houses of learning. I especially love the fact that in the same rooms where we teach during the week, students gather on Sunday for their church meetings. It's a comprehensive vision of what education is. Well, I've made a quick attempt to reunite reason and faith, and I've done so because this isn't just a theological game. Separating the two can have grave consequences. In the pages of the journal First Things, there's been a recent flurry of articles about the secularization of American universities. Our university administration and the Board of Trust have quoted from this dialogue. One of the suppositions in several articles are that if church universities seek academic excellence as the secular world sees it, they're bound to become secular. That makes no sense to me. What's wrong with secular standards of academic excellence? Show me conflicts between that kind of excellence and Mormon theology. Imagine Joseph Smith saying that if there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report or praiseworthy, as long as academics don't think it's excellent, we seek after these things. But the fact is, many American colleges founded by religious groups have become secular, and our board and our administration might follow a similar path. I want to quote, though, from one of the articles that I found especially revealing. This is The Decline and the Fall of the Christian College by James Birchall. He reviews the history of Vanderbilt University. It was founded in 1875, the same year BYU was founded, by the Methodist Church as a Methodist college. They happened to get their money from a non-Methodist, Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was trying to assuage his guilt at having used a lot of poor working people to make his fortune. But during the next 25 years, Vanderbilt moved away from its Methodist roots and finally became secular. I'm going to quote a few of the things from Birchall's text that seem relevant to me in a BYU context. One, there was a period of great intellectual turbulence when fresh findings and methods and disciplines raised fearful philosophical challenges to theology. Spokesmen for the church's concerns, by a compound of incapacity and animosity, exacerbated the apparent hostility between the church and religious scholarship, rigorous scholarship. I've tried to describe moments in our own recent history when, to repeat, spokesmen for the church's concerns, if not by a compound of incapacity and animosity, then out of some sort of fear, exacerbated the apparent hostility between the church and rigorous scholarship. Two, the estrangement from the sponsoring church occurred at a time when the funding the church may have provided was clearly inadequate for the new academic ambitions of the university, and when new secular sources were offering an infusion of funds. That's not the case at BYU. We're well-funded, and if there's a break, it wouldn't come from that problem. Three, there was a transfer of primary loyalty from the church to the academic guild, especially on the part of the faculty. Why, Birchall asks? Because faculty lost touch with the church and the church with the faculty. Because, quote, the governance that the angry general conference wanted to have and sued to retain was not what would have done the church any good in the days to follow. For it, this board, this conference, had narrowed its view of what it means to be Methodist to things like a religious test for all faculty and disciplinary control over students. Absent any larger vision of Christian education, this program was unrelievedly negative and assured the educational reformers that the church had no stomach for ambitious scholarship. I've been trying to show that while not unrelievedly so, much of our current vision is what it means to be Mormon at a Mormon university is negative, and that we fear, for reasons I fail to grasp, ambitious scholarship. Next, there was a progressive devolution of church identifiers, first from Methodist to generically Christian, then to generically religious, then to flatly secular. Why? Birchall's answer is because, quote, an effective bond to the Methodist Church instinctively evoked references to bigotry, exclusion, narrowness, sectarianism, and selfishness. There's no acknowledgement of any intrinsic benefit for the mind in Methodism and no exploration of the more general Christian faith which would suggest that it was illuminative to the mind. We are at risk here. The word Mormon can and does evoke bigotry, exclusion, narrowness, and sectarianism. You've read John Gardner's 1982 novel, Mickelson's Ghosts. You ran into phrases like Mormons as a sea of drab faces, dutiful, bent-backed, hurrying obediently, meekly across an endless, murky plain, timidly smiling beasts, imaginationless, family people, unusually successful in business and agriculture, non-drinkers, non-smokers, no real fault but dullness. Or in Tony Kushner's 1992 play, Angels in America, a Mormon woman describes Salt Lake City as a hard place, baked dry, abundant energy, not much. That's a combination that can wear a body out. Edward Abbey sees us similarly in Desert Solitaire, as does John le Carré in The Russia House. Birchall's point is that when a church begins to harp on the reason-faith dichotomy, denigrating its supposed academic enemy, those who know the value of reason will abandon ship. Although we have a theology radically affirming intelligence as the glory of God, our actual practice is making us. Birchall also points out that most of Vanderbilt's second-generation faculty were loyal to the church, as well as being academics. But that's the very group, he points out, that laid the groundwork for secularization of the university. I think that's the situation at BYU at the present. Most of the faculty are loyal to the church, as well as being academics. There are some, of course, who aren't loyal to the church, and there are some who aren't academics. But if we and our Board of Trustees continue to proceed from a foundation of fear, we could well go the way of Vanderbilt. On the other hand, if we were to aggressively assert the connections between reason and faith on Joseph Smith's model, the opposing forces of sectarianism and secularization would be rendered impotent. While he was president of BYU, Dallin Oaks argued similarly, I'm running on borrowed time here, argued similarly in a discussion of BYU's connection with Jim Jensen's work on dinosaurs. That's Dinosaur Jim, right? Quote from Dallin Oaks. Jensen points out that the bones are there and cannot really be ignored by a major university that is almost literally sitting on top of them. Oaks suggested that the board give controlled but expanding support to research in Rocky Mountain paleontology and pursue the private funding of a museum to exhibit findings. In doing so, he said, we demonstrate the church has nothing to fear from legitimate research. In fact, the church university fosters it. That's the way to get rid of the problem, is to foster learning of all kinds. What keeps us from fulfilling this vision? I think it's distrust and fear. Again, I quote President Oaks, in a memo to faculty. While church authorities know we have testimonies, they question our judgment and sensitivity. We must not have anything done at BYU or said publicly by BYU teachers and administrators that can be misinterpreted. It doesn't matter that it couldn't reasonably be so used or that it was distorted. We must not give occasion for retaliation or give ammunition to our enemies, unquote. That's not the kind of climate where good scholarship will flourish. If I had time, I would quote that wonderful quote by Hubie Brown that said, we're not so much concerned with whether your thoughts are orthodox or heterodox, just that you have thoughts. We've got in our history this wonderful affirmative sense for academics. I'll end with a story that Marlon Jensen, Elder Jensen, knew, a member of the Quorum of the 70, quoted, and he's quoting J. Golden Kimball here. Elder Mazur visited Bear Lake Stake in the interest of Brigham Young Academy and filled an appointment at Meadowville, Rich County, Utah in 1881. The meeting was held in a log schoolhouse. Language cannot express the impression made. The spirit and personality of the man burned into my soul and awakened me to a realizing sense of what life and religion mean. I drank in his words as I was anhungered. I repented in sackcloth and ashes. No power could prevent me from attending Brigham Young Academy. My brother Elias and I, together with our mother, went to Provo at great cost and sacrifice. And all who know us can look back to 1881 and ascertain just what Dr. Mazur did for me. Besides the testimony of the powerful effects of an educator and an education, two things stand out in this passage. The fact that Carl Mazur is referred to both as elder and doctor, and Kimball's phrase, combining life and religion. quote, "He awakened me to a realizing sense of what life and religion mean." Life and religion are the same thing. We don't need two universities at BYU.
I would choose to comment briefly on this talk and leave some time that you also may ask questions. I worry a little bit about becoming too anecdotal either on my part and have some criticism even of the first two or three pages of this paper for recounting anecdotes and stories that even could be considered hearsay. Before I come to that, I want to begin with another point. Not too many years ago, I went back to Parley's Creek. We called it Crick when I was a kid. I used to fish in Parley's Creek, and boy, I caught some big fish. I thought they were big. I went back there, and the whole thing had changed. It wasn't at all like I had remembered. Parley's Creek and Mulder's Barn was gone, and everything else in East Mill Creek. It wasn't quite the same. You know the experience I'm referring to. Maybe paradise, paradise lost. I wonder if what Scott is looking at in the early part of this paper, and I'm not sure if I should call you Brother Scott or Sister or Professor Scott or Professor Abbott, whatever the case is, but Scott will do for the moment. Scott returns to BYU as a professor after having received a bachelor's and a master's degree there and then getting a degree at another university and teaching at still a third. Returns to BYU in a very different status. He himself is older, and he is experiencing the university from a much different perspective. He's on the faculty. He's not the student experiencing the golden age, or if you will, the paradise, and perhaps a paradise lost that he has briefly described, or very adequately described to us today. So I'm concerned about one's perception. We perceive the world from where we are, the position we take, and it's different. I want to respond just to two or three of the things that I'm a little critical of in the first part of the paper. Responding to somewhat hearsay, I don't know about this woman in the department, and I don't know what is said in elevators. I grew up as a young man in Salt Lake hearing a lot of elevator stories, if any of you remember those, about things that were heard from the first presidency as they went up the elevator. I don't put a lot of trust and stock in it. I'm sorry that I become a little bit of a skeptical scientist, and I say I need just a little more proof of that, because I could also tell you some other stories, anecdotes, that might show another side to that life. In preparation for this and concerned about the mention of an imminent divorce between the religious studies area and the rest of the university, I called and talked to several people. Robert Millett, who is the Dean of Religious Education, received his Ph.D. from Florida State University and is very concerned that his professors have that background. Now, maybe he represents a new thing, and the statistics that Scott has given us relate from 1984 to 1991. This year, there were three new hires new people were hired in the religious education area. One of those had a Ph.D. from Harvard University. A second had his Ph.D. from Denver University and his master's degree from Harvard University. And the third, indeed, is receiving his Ph.D. from Brigham Young University from the Department of Botany. So you may want to wonder about how that works into the religious area. But at least there's an indication that not only are others aware of it outside, but the religious education area itself is also concerned that it have a broad base. They are attempting, and talking with Don Cannon as late as just this morning, he indicated to me, yes, we have used much of the CES pool because those are the people who have been willing to teach large sections and who somehow have had experience, and we've seen them as teachers, and he doesn't deny the fact. Yes, we are hiring them to teach because that's what we need as we're trying to teach some 30,000 students a year or every semester. I'm exaggerating. There are about something like 22,000 enrolled, as I understand, in religion education classes. So the problem is understood. Others are looking at it but finding some difficulty in arriving at a solution. You mentioned a hit list that had been rumored, and the university has officially denied the rumor. That is, we received a memo saying, no, there was no such thing as a hit list. I called the individual. In this case, I will not mention his name, but I could. I called the individual who was rumored to be number one on the hit list and asked him his response. He said he knew nothing of it. He had heard the same rumors, but no one had made any complaints or overtures to him. So maybe we're looking at some a little bit of anecdotal information here in the first part of the paper. I don't want to say all is well in Zion. I get warned against that in a certain book that we read with regularity. But I do want to say one has to be careful to not emphasize only those negative things, and Scott has not emphasized. He gave us a list at the first of some of the things that he enjoys at BYU and has found very advantageous. I would add two or three others. Principal among them, for me at least, and I think for a good many others, has been something called salaries. They're pretty darn good. They're much better than my colleagues who are teaching here at the University of Utah, and I do appreciate that. Thank you. I am grateful for a sense of community that I find at Brigham Young University, a sense that I'm participating in something quite broad with a lot of other people and not just filling a very small niche in a department. I really do feel something that used to exist in many universities. Maybe we can talk of a golden age, a concept of sense of community among faculty, administration, and students. I appreciate, as Scott has mentioned, these seminars we've had. I learned much from Ernest Boyer and a good many of the others that Scott tells about. These are free to faculty. In fact, I think we're paid to go, if I'm not mistaken. I think we get that possibly get some money, $50 gift certificate at the bookstore or something of that nature. I found a strong support system at Brigham Young University for me as well as for students. We recently initiated a faculty center with some very dynamic people and concerned that undergraduate teaching be carried out in a very good way. I view us as a developing university, a university that's always open for new programs and willing to fund them. I've just spent spring term in Mexico with a group of 16 students teaching literacy in some of the tiniest villages, and not only literacy but all of the other things that change agents get involved with. I would have a hard time doing that at many other universities. Some very generous travel funds have been mentioned, an excellent library system that's still expanding where money is available. But now that's not the gist of the paper, and I don't want to get involved in that, just to say there are approaches to look. Many of you have different approaches. Many of you have come here and, you know, saying, tell us the latest rumors so we can take them back to wherever we're going, or tell us about how the university is in decline. And that's one of my major questions that I want to pose to Scott and ask him to respond. Is it getting worse? That seemed to be some indication of what you're saying, Scott, that the university did have perhaps a better time, although you didn't make that up, but you didn't elaborate that. But are things getting worse? Is there indeed more control? Is there a stronger division between this faith and reason approach to knowledge now than there was 10 years ago or 20 years ago? I would hope you would respond to that. I would only give my observation and then let you somehow respond to it. I've been teaching at Brigham Young University for 20 years. When I came, my father counseled me not to come to Brigham Young University. He had worked in a church education system and said, you make up your own mind, but he said, be careful because there may be things that make faith difficult when you receive your paycheck from the same organization in which you put your faith. He had some of that that experience. I have not had that experience. I haven't seen, if you will, a decline over that period of 20 years. I guess I'm trying to look at a little broader historical perspective and say, over that 20 years, I've heard some talks on both ends of this spectrum, develop the faith spectrum, develop the reason, but not divorce one or another. I think you've selected one, maybe two talks that have shown that without looking at the fact that there are several other talks. Just as late as yesterday, I had an interview with, there's no sense hiding names here, with Marion D. Hanks, as I'm doing a biography of my father. I was amazed at the openness with which he talked of his associations with various brethren and some severe conflicts that he had as they related to Brigham Young University, to the church education system, and so on. He was very open about it, and if I had gotten, as I got his response, if I had used at least that personal response, I would get quite a different picture of where the conflicts may be centered, or if it is getting worse. How bad is it? Is another question that I would hope you might identify. Is it bad? Do you feel specific restrictions from and what you're doing? I do not. I have received, as another member in the department down here sitting in his BYU blue, or a member of our college sitting in his BYU blue, I've received plenty of letters. Letters to the editor in the Provo Herald and to BYU, and a good many letters that have come to the church office and are forwarded back to the administrative vice president, eventually to the dean and to the department chairman and so on. I gave a talk on one occasion on Mormonism and Marxism in Latin America. I didn't come up with a title. It was assigned to me by the people who were planning a religious education thing. Took quite a bit of flack on the talk, but I didn't change knowing what the flack could be, didn't change the nature of the talk. I did not advocate Marxism. I want to say that right now. But that was how it was read by a good number of people who read the short summary, did not attend the talk, of course, but read the summary in the student local newspaper. With all of that, I'm saying at any other university, and I've taught it for others, I've found other concepts, other reasons for getting some flack as well, but not the dichotomy, of course, of the religious versus the reason or the faith versus the reason thing. Simply other reasons for having conflicts. At the University of Wisconsin, where I taught, I got a lot of flack because I went against the student demonstrators because I didn't think their demands were proper and right. And again, we got some letters to the editor and other things. So there are other reasons, other ways in which one may, quote, get in trouble. I would like, as a sort of a third question, Scott, to for you to give us some, I know this is a big bill, but to give us some indication of how might we circumscribe, and I believe I'm using your term here, the reason-faith artificial dichotomy. You're going back to Joseph Smith and using his period of time as saying here was sort of a golden age when reason and faith were not separated. I don't know that's enough the quotes that you made are enough to really convince me of that, because there was that debate was going on even then, enough to indicate that there must have been enough people feeling the negative about it. How do we really come up, how do we really circumscribe the reason faith or the reason revelation dichotomy? And is there successful examples of how it's been done on any departments on Brigham Young University campus or by individuals? Yes, you've given us some good examples. And as a result of those good examples, I say there are strong possibilities for continued good examples and not a reason to panic and fear and say Brigham Young University is going down the tubes or Brigham Young University will be split apart as Vanderbilt did in the sense of losing its sponsorship. You also mentioned that Brigham Young University is adequately funded right now, which is a concept that I very much agree to. But that's the one that I worry about. This split may precisely be the thing that breaks that up. If the split is there, if that continues, then that, as personalities, affect a church and affect a board of trustees. It may be that would start to limit or cut down, or perhaps even at some point eliminate the sponsorship. President Oakes, at one time, as president of Brigham Young University, was very concerned that we were not filling a unique function, as he saw the LDS hospital sold out with the explanation that this was not necessarily a church function, and there were plenty of other hospitals in the town or in the area. Why should the church continue putting money into a hospital? President Oakes's concern was the same rationale may be used for a university. There are other universities. That's a state concept. Why should we continue doing it? But as we've understood from at least a year ago, June, President Lee got very, very good vibes from the brethren, from the Board of Trustees, that, and I shouldn't say the brethren because there are women on that board, that got very good vibes from that board that there was a permanent commitment, or at least a very long-range commitment, to the university. So Scott, I've raised some questions, and maybe you would choose to respond to those. If you can take a minute or two, please do so. And then if we have time, let's entertain some questions from people in the audience. Thank you.
I'm proud to respond to Ted. He's one of the examples of the religious scholars that that I experienced at BYU and still experience. In a person like this, you don't find the split that I was talking about. In fact, we like him so much that we tried to hire his brother last year in our department. He asked several questions. Let me respond to the statement he made about the church education system as the breeding ground for teachers in the... It's not a college. It's just called religious education. They're even separated in the catalog. You can't find them under departments. They're up under right after tuition or something like that. Yeah. So even in our catalog, we split them, separate them somehow. I also spoke with several of them, wondering if what I was seeing in the catalog was correct. And they mentioned the same thing about they have to teach enormously large sections, which is unfortunate for students because then they're not discussion sections or anything like that. And so they are, in fact, going after people who will teach many more classes than most of us have to teach in a well-funded department. And other universities do the same thing for undergraduate language instruction. I saw that happening at Vanderbilt. Invariably, that creates an underclass and an overclass. Invariably, that brings in people who don't have fresh ideas. They don't have time to have fresh ideas. They're teaching six or seven huge sections of religion. I think if they continue on that course, they'll get professors who aren't as smart as the students, and then religion will get a bad name. And if you get religion with a bad name at BYU, then what have you got? You've lost the vision that we have. My suggestion would be to have Ted teach a Book of Mormon class every other semester, and then the students will know that it's important, that it's taught by the best professors, and these religious education people won't have to teach so many sections. But the one of the chairs of one of the departments there is actively working to make that happen less and less. They call it transfer faculty, and he wants to have fewer transfer faculty because there's not as much control over them as there is over the regular teachers.
And according to their surveys, they are not as highly rated by students. Students rate, they say, that when they did this education professor is the highest when they're giving the rankings, and transfer faculty lower.
I think that's because they bear their testimony with less practiced fervor. you know the voice that we like to feel. Oh, that's likely. Although I saw a memo by a department chair in religious education which said faculty who do not grade on a strict curve and give a good many D's will feel it in their pocket when it comes to salary time. So they're trying to address that. Are things getting worse at BYU? One way to look at it is they're getting better every day. Do you remember the Wilkinson era? It's been a while since we've had a spy scandal on campus. So,
who are you?
I point simply to that comment made to a friend of mine by a member of the Board of Trustees that tensions between the Board of Trustees and faculty have never been greater. That doesn't mean that BYU is worse now. I think it's better than it was when I was a student. I began as Wilkinson was finishing his work there. And I carefully chose teachers and carefully chose situations I got into and knew I was doing that. So I chose a paradise of sorts. And I didn't know as much. And I think you're right. It's getting better as opposed to getting worse. And that's what I tried to express by when I said I'm very happy to be there and I know I haven't made a bad decision. For doing that. Have I ever felt any restrictions at BYU as a faculty member? On the contrary. Somebody asked me at lunch today, what does your department chairman think about this paper you're giving? I said, He helped me write it. He wrote stunning on the top and said, you better go get it, and you better get it published, and so on. I've never felt any restrictions, I wouldn't be here, I suppose. I heard Ted give his talk on Mormonism and Marxism, and it was wonderful. And it was reported badly. I think I'll stop there. You also ask about reason and faith, but we'd like some questions from you.
I don't know who's the moderator. Are you the moderator?
Yes, I'm the moderator. If I could just have you guys repeat the question.
Work that out. Who's that major
problem? All right. But she says that we both have missed the point that... Well, I'm not going to go on. I'm
that's
sorry.
That's another point.
What that's what I was trying to describe with that anecdote with Elder, with President Oakes and Jim Jensen and the dinosaurs. I think if BYU would do for feminism and for sociological studies of the church and everything else, what we did for dinosaurs, we'd be fine.
Still under the stadium.
All right, the dinosaur bones are still under the stadium, and women may in fact face problems in